don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
We're back in studio today after our memorable trip to the Oris last week to meet Michael D. Higgins, President of Ireland, and now unbackable favourite to become second captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2025 after amassing an all-time record total of 90 points. Wow. What did it for you? Was it a suggestion that he may be the proud owner of Robbie Brady's jersey from the win against Italy? Or simply the intimidating aura of the presidency, which was, let's face it, always going to be worth an extra 10 to 20 points?
I was in the man's study, you know? It's quite intimidating atmosphere on. I mean,
did you give more points than you intended to walking in? That's all I want to know.
I knew he was going to get in the 85 to 87 mark. Did I see 90 in his future on? I don't know.
By the way, I'd like to take this opportunity to apologise to any GAA cornerbacks out there who may have been offended during our interview with President Higgins.
Yes.
He described himself as a bad hurler who ended up playing in the usual...
I was very bad hurler.
His words, not mine. In the usual place you put people of dubious quality, cornerback. I'm sure if the President had his time over again, he would clarify that people of dubious quality can be played right across the full back line, Murph, and not
here,
just in the
now
corner.
On. Don't
come
back
on.
Down, double down.
Yep. Thank you for all the kind messages about last week's episode. It even got the seal of approval from previous series champ Dorothy Cross, who was magnanimous enough to call President Higgins a hero, despite the fact his score bumped her off joint top spot on the all-time list.
That's big of her.
That is good stuff. Dorothy was a champion swimmer who came close to qualifying for the Olympics, a sporting career. She revealed on the show back in 2017, the reason I remember those details so vividly is that it's rare enough we have a guest with actual, genuine athletic ability.
Yes.
But I'm pleased to report we have one on today's episode. We ended our last show with the poetry of Michael D. Higgins. Today, we turn to one of Ireland's brightest young poets, Alvy Carraher. Earlier this month, Alvy won the Evan Boland Award, a prize that was set up to honour one of our greatest ever poets, which tells you a lot about just how talented Alvy is. What really caught her eye was her latest collection, What Remains the Same, where she writes about what was a difficult childhood. But even at its darkest, I think she manages to write about her experiences in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming, Murph.
Yeah, it's a really gorgeous collection of poems. And her aim, I suppose, is to state her truth plainly. And that can be stark sometimes, but it's so accessible for all that.
Yeah.
But Alvy's been writing for years. The Men I Keep Under My Bed and Falling in Love with Broken Things are two of her earlier poetry collections. She's just a huge, huge talent, so we're absolutely delighted to have her.
We've wanted to speak to Alvy for a while now, and that was before we knew the full extent of her sporting ability, because let's just say US college track and field programs are not noted for handing out athletic scholarships to just anyone. So the fact that Alvy was chosen to go down that route is a clear marker of her athletic talent. If you demand that she show you her medals.
And I do.
Okay. How about the two Irish national steeplechase titles she won as a teenager? How about that?
Okay.
That might soften your confidence.
That's got some game.
She's also a cross-country champion. Murph, maybe the president's lead is not so safe after all. How does a leaderboard look after last week's drama?
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Owen, the president has broken all known non-sportspersoning records. As we've discussed, smashing the magical 90-point barrier for the first time. That should surely be job done for the season.
You would have thought.
But you might well ask, Owen, how have poets fared on the show in the past? Theo Dorgan got 76 points for sailing around Cape Horn. Dernie Griffa was obsessed with Claire Hurler PJ Fingers O'Connell.
Oh, yeah.
And got 84 points for some sterling work in the MS Readathon. But I'm forgetting someone, aren't I, Owen? Aren't I? Because the 90-point man from last week is also a poet. So there's nothing those rhyme scribblers can't do. Alvy set fair for a Herculean effort. We'll see how close it gets her inside the hour.
Get in touch on Instagram at Second Captains. Email editor at secondcaptains.com. Alvy Carraher will join us in studio next.
A heart of three. So tell me what's wrong with.
Yeah, Irish fans have been flocking to the church of Father John Misty. He had big gigs in Dublin, Galway, Cork and Belfast this week. That one, of course, is his classic Real Love Baby. Now, our guest today is one of Ireland's best young poets. And crucially, she arrives in the studio with a very strong sporting pedigree as a national track and field champion, no less. Alvy Carraher, welcome to studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, listen, we'll get to the poetry, but let's chart your path to athletics glory here, okay? Were you into competitive running from a very young age?
We should say that the national championship was underage, because that sounds like I was a senior champion.
No, it's only an underage national championship. I don't think that counts, Murph. Alvi, thanks for being here. That's the end of the conversation. And it's an under 19 and under 20?
Under 19 and under 20.
National steeplechase championship.
We're taking that
That's
all day
good
long.
Enough for
We're
me. That but all day long. Was that something you've been striving for from a very young age, or did it happen a bit differently?
No, I wasn't really a runner for a long time. Till I was 15, I started running. I read in a book that dogs grow really long toenails, and they're in kind of a lot of pain if you don't clip them or bring them for a run. So I started running the dog up and down the road.
An attempt to file the dog's nails.
File the dog's nails, yeah. I'm sure there's easier ways, but that seemed like logical to me. I think he liked it when we were running a mile.
I think more than that.
Yeah, like when it got to the point where I was doing kind of 8 or 10 mile loops in the fields, he'd do the first mile with me and he'd lie down. And then he'd wait till the end when I would do strides up and down the field and he'd join in then.
You'd pick him up on the last lap. I think I've played football with a lot of characters like this, actually. Yeah. It basically would hide behind a bush and at the eighth of eight laps and re-emerge for the last lap.
People didn't really run along the roads in Tipperary where I grew up, and the neighbours saw me and they would pull over in the car and ask if I was all right. And then they came over at Christmas one year with biscuits to tell my parents to send me into Nina to the athletics club.
All right. When you started doing it in a more structured way then, when you went to the athletics club in Nina, did you pick up a love for it pretty quickly? Did you really enjoy it?
Yeah, I loved running. Maybe not racing, but I love the training and I still love training. And I met a coach, Sean Finn, there, and I insisted from day one, having no idea what cross country was, that I was a cross country runner.
Right.
And they were trying to make me into a high jumper because they thought I was a tall 12-year-old, but I was actually a small 15-year-old. So,
What did you enjoy about it then? What did you enjoy particularly about the training part of it?
I think it's a good outlet for everything. You push yourself past what you think you can. And there's camaraderie as well without having to talk. I mean, I think that's in sports anyway, that you're part of, you belong as long as you can run hard. And that's all you have to do. You don't really have to say anything or be particularly funny or entertaining. Because I was a very quiet, shy person. So it was nice to have something where no one is really, you're not supposed to be talking when you're running. So, yeah.
Camaraderie without talking is, that's a lovely way to describe team sport or even an individual sport that you train with other people for.
Well, yeah, because one of my big problems playing team sports was that I couldn't shout loud enough. You know, I'd be like, Shauna, pass me the ball.
You said it was an outlet. Was it a form of escape or escapism from what was a very difficult childhood?
We had a kind of a tough household. And by the time I was that age, I realized how unfair a lot of the things happening in our house were. So to be able to go out when you were angry and just run really hard down the road for like a few miles makes all the difference in the world. And you see it all the time. Like you see kids go out and kick soccer balls with so much rage that you wonder whose head they imagine that is.
Yeah. As well as the talent, you also were told were very determined at this point in your career. I mean, maybe too determined for your own good.
My coach was brilliant because I just thought I could train like an Olympian from day one, and he would kind of pull me back and say, well, maybe there's like a few steps in between this and that.
Nina AC and the Olympics.
Yeah. I think I was always like that. I think some people are and some people aren't, and that a lot of people like that end up doing what seems like absurd things because they just are determined. Like there are stories going all the way back, like I don't like help and I want to figure everything out myself. And I think I was that way. And having known other athletes, a lot of them are built that way.
What do you mean by doing absurd things?
Like, for instance, when my coach was like, oh, you know, you're running a mile a day, maybe we'll build up to a 10-mile run. And the crucial words were build up, and I just went out and ran 10 miles. And before that, I'd been going out for 10 minutes. So I disappeared for like 2 hours and got lost and came back, and everyone thought I was probably dead or abducted. And just this kind of extremism that maybe you need help when you're young to control it a little bit.
Was there a moment when things clicked for you then between you and your coach in terms of your approach?
Yeah, I came dead last in my first outdoor track. Or not dead last, I bet a girl with asthma. And
asthma is a common theme in our series this year, actually. It came up with Siobhan McSweeney recently. Yeah.
But everyone else creamed me, and I had been doing kind of my own thing and insisting I should go on these long runs and do all this extreme stuff. And then I just decided after that, because it was so humiliating, to do what my coach said for a summer and see. And then after that, I won, I think, the Tipperary cross country, and it was all the same girls and they didn't come near me. And I thought, maybe he's right sometimes.
I'm prepared to accept that this guy might have a clue what he's talking
Did
about.
Did you start getting confidence in yourself then, though, in terms of your running? That actually, I'm quite good at this. I'm beating a lot of people now.
I think one of the hard things is that maybe not. Like when I look back at running overall, I would say that I failed spectacularly. But
hang on a second. Sorry, I've cut across you, but you broke national records. You won national titles. You got a scholarship to Louisiana. We're going to talk about that later on. I mean, surely that's not failing spectacularly.
The times are not particularly impressive if you look at what girls are running these days. I never broke any of the times that I wanted to break. And in Ireland at that age, a lot of girls drop out of sports. And I think it's pretty easy to rise up if you have any level of discipline and dedication. And then when you go over to the States, you're used to kind of coming in the top few in the nationals. And then suddenly there's 200 girls that are just as good as you. And I think you have to, especially if you're like ambitious or determined, take some sort of stock of what your strengths are. And even giving it everything, I felt over there, I was never going to be the best. Like they were so, there was people there. There was a girl on our team who could run under 17 minutes with no training. She just could run under 17 minutes for a 5K, which is completely effortless. It's a different level.
Would you say you're hard on yourself though?
Yes.
And does that extend to your writing as well? Would you have a similar approach to your writing, your professional career?
I think I get very frustrated when I don't live up to my own standards on the page, but that I've learned that a writing teacher said to me before, like, one of your strengths is being prolific, and out of that will fall the good stuff. And I've seen that in running as well. If you put in all this work and you have all these bad runs and mediocre runs, every now and then you rise a little bit above your expectations. And I think with poems, I would always be trying for that one little moment where I've gone beyond myself and I've surprised myself as opposed to anybody else, really. But another thing that someone said to me once about running was that the difference between your best and your worst isn't that big to anybody else, but to you those 5 seconds in the 1500 meter are the end of the world. And that's the same with writing, I think. Like, you're so hung up on this one little sentence, and I would be too, but there is a point at which you have to let it go and move on. And you see it as well in spoken word. Even they're less perfectionist, but they are doing the same poem for 10 years because I think there's a fear that you'll never live up to that best poem. And part of the thing that I like about poetry compared to, say, novel writing, which is a really different animal, is that every day could be a blank page if you want, or every week you start again at scratch. And there's something really terrifying but also lovely about that.
It is interesting because you're clearly competitive in the way that you speak about your writing, but competitive with yourself, competitive with what you've done before, as opposed to feeling like you're in competition with others or with the great poets of the past or something like that.
But I think that's meaningless almost, or it has meaning, but the thing that you're trying to do with poetry is so different from that. I mean, the thing that they seem to have done well is people that get celebrated is they just sort of stuck to their guns and they didn't pay too much attention to all the noise and distraction, because that creates, and I know from running, so much fear. Like if you're looking at a start line and you're like, all those girls run this time, this time, this time. And I don't need to be thinking that about other people's books, because also I love to read. So I don't want to ruin reading for myself by thinking about what awards people are getting.
Well, how does that work though? When you win a prestigious award like the Evan Boland Award that Trinity and Poetry Ireland give out, as you did earlier this month, and congratulations on that, by the way, that must be a big moment for you, right?
It's a nice moment, but I think if it doesn't matter that someone else wins it, it shouldn't matter that I win it. Someone else will win it in 2 years' time, and there's no telling which one of us's bodies of work will survive the test of time. Like, ultimately, it's a lovely honour, but it's also shouldn't have anything to do with what I write next, and it shouldn't cripple me or make me think I can't do the next thing. Like, the one thing that I always do after a book is write something completely different next, because I feel like I've done everything I can in that genre for a little bit of time. And I remember someone saying to me, my second book was about a girl and her pet chicken. It was a young adult novel. And that was the whole idea, was just a girl. And it just grew from there because I can't think like a novel. And I remember someone saying, would you not be embarrassed to write that under your name? And I was like, I don't know why I would be embarrassed about finishing writing a novel. But OK, it's just a perspective.
You won that award for What Remains the Same, which we have in front of us here. A brilliant collection of poems about your childhood, which you described in the Irish Times as being about family estrangement and the aftermath of growing up in an abusive environment. Was it very hard for you to put all that on paper?
Yeah, but I think it was necessary. I think part of being a writer is to be as honest as you can about your life and your experiences. And that, I think it's Joyce that said if he could get to the heart of Dublin, he could get to the heart of all cities. And I think that's how you kind of have to approach your own life, and you can't really compartmentalize it, especially if every time you sit down to write, that's what ends up on the page. If you don't try to kind of plan what you're writing and just see what comes, and if that's what comes and you ignore it, you're not going to be able to finish a book, because obviously that there's all this inner voice asking to speak, and so you have a choice to kind of suppress that or not.
Had you spoken about it in that way before? Did this collection of poems allow you to speak about your own experiences in a new way, do you feel?
Before, I would have allowed a lot of editorial from family, and I think at the point of writing this book, maybe near the start of writing it, I was still sending poems and being told I could not publish them, and I was thinking, do I have to wait for other people to die in order to be able to say what happened to me from my perspective? You know, I think to silence to think about your life and silencing yourself for 30 years seems mad if you think you want to be a writer.
One of the poems, Alvi, that stood out to us is called Library. Would you mind reading that for us and for our listeners?
Sure. Library. Sometimes I wonder why she brought us there so religiously. She was young and thwarted, but she knew to do that much, to show us books full of lives other than the one we were living. Maybe all some people can give you is a way out. Maybe forgiveness is understanding that's enough. Look, I read for 30 years and ended up here, a life built from books. I've turned myself inside out and nobody died or pricked a finger. Imagine this, I was once so scared I wouldn't speak. There was a wall between what I felt and others heard. I couldn't translate until I pressed pen to paper. Here was my mother tongue. I put down my life and walked through the covers to another.
That's beautiful. We talked earlier on about running as a sort of outlet or a bit of escape. It sounds like books was maybe something similar for you from a young age?
Yeah, from a very, very young age, books. I think very young I found poems actually that my mother had written too in her whole life in the back of a recipe book and on scraps of paper, and remember thinking that's very interesting that she feels that way. And I had a teacher who was obsessed with Patrick Kavanagh, so even at 7, 8 we were doing poems that you do a lot later, and we had no understanding of them. We were doing them in Irish as well. I mean, she had a deep love of poetry, and that kind of was amazing to me because the language was so mysterious. And then it was a very religious community. So, you know, you're sitting in church every Sunday listening to these quite beautiful prayers, even if you don't believe them. There is something about all these people coming here just to listen to words.
Yeah. What were the poems that your mother wrote? What were they about?
There was one called Blackbird about it pecking out her eyes, and there was another about her frustration. So I think from those, I already knew because she confided a lot in us, but that she was very unhappy in her marriage and her life was what I understood from them. And I think the thing in poetry is that it normally has or often has underlying themes or ideas or sadness or longing that isn't quite maybe articulated there, but you can feel it off the poem, like it has a pulse or something like that.
Did writing this collection feel like a way of taking the power back? As in, there was no way for you to change things as a kid, but as an adult, you can do something about it through words?
Maybe the collection, more than empowering, allowed me to kind of pull back from what I had lived through and question it and think about family stories and the way that I saw my own role and personality or who I was. Like I almost felt like a part of them more than an individual. And to be able to question all that within this and look for something else, maybe that was just me. And I had a bit of a nervous breakdown doing it. But I think that you have to take breaks. I think there was 6 months when I didn't write. There is the other thing of kind of pushing yourself and a feeling that you know you need to go somewhere. And then when you get there, you have to trust it's going to be okay. Like in publishing this, I really had a huge amount of anxieties. And I remember writing them all down, and most of them involved people maybe dying or not being okay. And in the end, it was fine. But really, I think it's like such a high level of maybe anxiety as a person about how other people yeah. feel before I would consider myself even.
Yeah,
your relationship with your sisters, I think it's very interesting. It kind of comes through here. It's something you explore in a poem called Ruptures.
Yeah, I have three sisters. One is a half-sister, and then I can read that.
Please.
Ruptures. You're basking outside in the sunshine, a cup of tea, books and a tatty pillow. It's nice to see some things stay the same, though you wear your hair differently now and your freckles are more apparent. A tub of peanut butter sits absently to one side. Last year, I watched you eat it from a spoon on a video chat and was reminded of us sneaking peanut butter from the kitchen and spooning it straight from the jar. When you were born, I remember the thrill of skidding down hospital halls, pushing through big double doors to get to you. We threw ourselves across our mother's stomach, rupturing something. She stayed calm and pale as she let us cradle you, taught us how to be gentle. Sister, I slip your name into conversations, though I have not told you anything in so long. You, who once knew everything. There seems to be no way for us to speak without all the old hurt showing up, making us both sound backward and ugly. I cannot tell you what it means to be gentle. Back then, it was easy. Keep still, support the head. There's just so much more to it now.
I can actually feel the emotion when you read the words out. Is it still there every time you see those words or read them out from the page?
Yeah, I think with a lot of the poems there are. And also I get nervous when I read them. So I have a little shake in my voice and people always think it's that I'm going to have like a little breakdown on stage.
Okay. All right.
But I'm okay.
That line, that no way for us to speak without all the old hurt showing up, that's so powerful. Is it inevitable that your relationship with your siblings is always going to be affected by things you go through together?
Yeah, and I think it helps that with time we have more awareness of how we impact each other. And I think across the country, sibling relationships that are tense are problem. Like I think a lot of people can relate to this. And there's lots of siblings that don't speak to each other. And there's lots of ways that you need to learn to be different as you get older and to be aware of each other's things and the things about you that might be just really hard for them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I worry a lot. Like I'll probably leave here now and go over everything I said in my head for like 3 days, or I'll be worried about it for weeks before. And I just thought everybody was like that. And I think I've learned that maybe some people don't ever think about what you just said to them ever again. It can be a weakness and a strength. So you have to be like anything pragmatic about it. I think if you're going to overthink a poem for 3 weeks, that's probably quite good. Mm. But maybe overthinking saying to someone, not right now.
The poems are beautiful though. Reading them this week, knowing that you're coming into us, it really struck me how kind of accessible, how close to the surface much of the emotion and much of the sort of the driving force of the poems are. so many of us have a relationship with poetry dating back to secondary school, and maybe, I don't know, an approach towards poetry that was, it's a puzzle to be solved and here are the keys and the clues, and after we've talked about it for a couple of weeks in English class, you now understand the poem. Whereas I read your poetry and I know what it's about. I know the emotions that you're reaching for and which you succeed in getting to so often in this collection. Is that important to you? Is that a deliberate thought in your head?
Yeah, I don't want someone to feel like they don't understand. The poetry I like is, it's almost like someone having a really lovely conversation with you or trusting you with something or leaning across the table, looking deep into your soul and saying, this is how it is for me, how is it for you? And I think that the way it's taught in school, like I used to get in big long arguments with my English teacher in essay form because I wouldn't speak in school, but she would tell us one thing a poem meant and how the poet was using all these techniques to do this thing. And I was so sure she was wrong. And I used to just write big long 16 page, you know, it'd be like, go home and write 4 pages about Seamus Heaney. And I'd go home and write her 16 pages tearing apart this idea that everything was intentional, because so much of it is a music or a sentence that they hear in their head or a feeling outside of, you know, like I feel like Leaving Cert students are taught to scan the poem for assonance. And
yeah. You know,
one of the things that's difficult in school is that you are prescribed maybe 4 poets, and the poems might have very little to do with you as a teenager, and we're all self-obsessed when we're teenagers. So it might not be the exact right entry, you know, because I don't think teenagers have a lot to say about death, and they might be doing a lot of poems about death, a lot of sonnets, a lot of old language. Like I think we did John Donne on our Leaving Cert, and that was just painful for me at that age. Even though I loved poetry, I did not like John Donne.
Yeah, I've been listening to the award-winning poet Alvy Carraher and some of her work from her latest collection on Second Captain Saturday. Alvy has a serious sporting background, having set a national record. Underage or not, it's a national record that we can confidently say will never be broken. We'll tell you why after the break.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
Alvy Carraher is an award-winning poet. She's with myself and Murph in studio today, and the news that we're breaking to you is that Alvy was also a serious track and field athlete, winning national titles, also earning an athletic scholarship to Louisiana University, which must have been quite a change for you, Alvy. How did that come about?
It came about because there was an Irish coach at that college, and so I think he keeps an eye on the juvenile track and field results. So he would have seen my name come up, I think, a few times. In Louisiana, I think that was a massive culture shock. One of the first people I saw was a full-blown cowboy with like Stetson and holsters and everything. And we used to do things like football games, and they would like parachute a mascot in a cowboy costume down, because we were the cowboy. Like I thought it was a joke when I got my acceptance letter that said, congratulations, you're a cowgirl. Am I? And like before races, the cross country girls would do this kind of huddle thing.
Yeah.
And a yeehaw. And like all the Irish girls, we would kind of sit there, stand there with the arms folded, like this is not happening again.
Well, you see Rashida Adeleke do it the whole time. She races for like the Longhorns. And you see her do like the hand gesture the whole time. Well, maybe on Instagram. Maybe it's not when she's racing for Ireland as well. But yes, you're Irish. The Irish runners were a little more circumspect about the cowgirl, longhorn, that whole vibe.
Yeah, because it involved one of the girls kind of putting her hands on her hips and doing a whole lasso. So, yeah. And we were like, we still have to run the race. Like, you don't know. But there'd be a team beside you being wolves and another one over there being bears. So I guess it's just a different culture. And they used to put like, you know, you'd have to wear all these matching ribbons in your hair and the socks, and they put the streaks, and there's none of that in Irish cross country. In Irish cross country, you're lucky if you have a pair of spikes. And like in the Munster Championships, I can remember one year, the sheep breaking onto it, or like in the Tipperary Championships, I was hit by a car one year that was pulling out of a car park.
And you're just like,
it was okay, like it only hit me gently, but like
I'm gonna say contact with a car of any sort is not gentle.
Did you enjoy the sporting side of it over there? I'd imagine you're pushed pretty hard in an American college.
I think it's really tough. It's the first, and probably a good experience to realise maybe I wasn't cut out to be an athlete, because you wake up at 5, 6 a.m., you're running classes, lunch, weights, pool, running, bed, like stagger out of bed. You're sore the whole time and you kind of double your training plus weights, plus pool. It's a kind of a crazy life. Like you get so thin and hungry and tired. I mean, it's a different time. We know a lot more. Like you're seeing girls of a different shape coming through now running. But I mean, back then it was believed, and you have girls like that are professional Nike athletes who've come out about the treatment they got. They were great underage runners, and then they were ashamed for their weight. Like one of the first things they do when you go over there is weigh you and publish your weight online. And then I think that's the first time in my life I was even aware of my weight properly, with all the heights and weights. And I remember all the girls debating like, oh, if you're an inch taller, then you can be 5 pounds heavier. But if you're, and that doesn't really go with body composition. And then the other thing is that you are fed in the canteen, so you don't have any access to adequate nutrition. And so you are hungry a lot of the time because the canteen's also only open certain times, and that might not go with your
measured
schedule.
Your training. Yeah.
So what sort of impact did this sort of routine have on you, do you think?
Yeah, I think like if I think then and the training and everything, I probably never ate, which is very technical, over 2000 calories in a day. And you probably needed to be eating 3000 with a high protein. And then when I went back and found all this out from a nutritionist, there is like a syndrome for girls that's Red S, which is where you would have a lot of kind of pulmonary problems, or you might have injury or things like this, because it's usually from malnutrition. So you're just not getting what you need. And it could be as simple as iron or vitamin D or something like that. But I know that I had that now because I had pneumonia quite like probably maybe every semester. I would get a really bad cold that would be quite hard to come back from right at your kind of peak. And I know at your peak is when you will get injured or sick. And I was never injured. I was always sick.
And you were running through all that.
Yeah, yeah. Like we ran the conference qualifiers and I had definitely full blown pneumonia at that stage. And I knew I couldn't really run well for more than 5 minutes. So I would just go out really hard because I had to get the qualifying time in the LSU. I don't know if you're familiar with LSU, but some of those big stadiums like the Florida Relays or that. And they play lots of obnoxiously loud music and there's a tiger in a enclosure nearby, like a real tiger on their campus. So you're kind of overwhelmed to begin with about the whole thing. And there's a proper stadiums and stands and all this. And so you feel a lot of pressure. And I had to run that qualifying time. So I just put the thing on my nose, do you know, the Paula Radcliffe, the little tape.
Yeah.
Took some Tylenol, like a shot of it, and just ran as hard as I could. And I remember like collapsing on the finish line and getting a big clap on the back for getting the qualifying time. But I could see on my hand, I was coughing up phlegm that had blood in it. And I remember seeing all the girls line up for the next race. And, you know, everything was just continuing. And I was like in need of an ambulance, probably. You know, when people think about an athlete's life, the food side is really big, especially if you have been from a young age told not to eat a lot and to stay thin. And then suddenly you realize to perform well. But what it really manifests as is that training is going really well for a few months, even sometimes, and then you will collapse.
Literally collapse while you're out running.
Yeah. So like it'll, and normally I'll get to the end of a race, like, but, and it's normally pulmonary for me. So it'll be a cold or something like that that will come on after that. Or,
you know what's funny though? It's a lot of elite sport, competitive sport, the message is drummed into you from a young age that you have to go through the pain barrier, all that kind of stuff, push your limits. But clearly that's warning signs there for you or for anybody.
Yeah, I think a doctor said to me best, she was like, you do realize when you're collapsing, there is no oxygen going to your brain if you've blocked out. And I think there's other things you don't think about at that time. You just kind of want, you think you've pushed yourself, you know, to the limit and clearly like gone a few steps over that. And you see it. You see these extreme, you know, these extreme runners, and they run across Death Valley with a broken foot, and it's celebrated.
Yeah.
But it doesn't set the best example for.
I would agree entirely. Accepting that as the norm, or accepting that as kind of the route to greatness, is just really not a very smart way to go about. Particularly when, as you say, like what you needed was someone with a science degree or with a degree in food nutrition to just sit down and say, right, here is what's actually going on in your body, and there are ways that we can mitigate this in some way, rather than a kind of grin and bear it vibe that is maybe prevalent in sport, and not just even top tier sport, that's just sport more generally.
Yeah, and I do think it's improving. Like, I think a lot of young athletes are doing a lot better with advocating for themselves. But, you know, there's a hangover. Like, there's a way we've thought about sports that's kind of like a sports montage that's not accurate.
Yeah.
Are you still running? Are you still running casually?
Yeah, just casually. I just run most days a little bit.
How casual can you be, though, if you've been competitive and if you are as competitive as you say you are? You clearly are, I think.
Well, I do chase people down, but only if I think they're not a real runner.
Sorry, what do we mean by this?
Well, like this morning, well, I didn't chase him down. I could hear him coming behind me like a thundering bull, so I just took off because I don't know what it is, and I don't actually think it has anything to do with them. I think it's a feeling inside me that I don't want to be that much of a fun runner. Like, I don't want to let myself go completely. Like, if someone has been medically prescribed running, then I should at least be jogging faster than them.
I think, to be fair, we all have that little bit. When I've gone running around the Phoenix Park and the like, it often happens that you and somebody else end up in a race, basically, right? Nobody says it. Nobody acknowledges it. Mm. Not even by body language. You just both know. You've clocked them, then you've gone past them. They haven't liked that. They've gone past you. You could go around the entire Phoenix Park, and I have done, racing people and being fuming if they end up tearing off, as Alvy invariably would if it happened in this scenario.
It's a feeling. It's a vibe.
Yeah,
it's a vibe.
You're just putting it out in the world without racing.
I mean, we've probably raced each other.
Possibly. Yeah, I've probably been beaten. If I see Alvy ahead of me, I'm thinking, okay, this is not a race. Yeah, if I see somebody more my own, sort of, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't pick your race against someone who's blatantly better than you.
A tiny bit faster is what you want. You want somebody a tiny bit faster just to push him. Now, in order to rank your sporting life today, Alvy, I need you to give us your all-time highlight. It's got to be the national titles in 2007.
Yes.
Underage titles.
Yeah, it is. So when I was, the year of my leaving cert actually, but the steeplechase was being run for the first time, which led to kind of a strange summer for me because I didn't know what that was. And I had to practice over hurdles, but I'd never actually gone over a steeple. I think we went at Munster's. My coach brought me over to it and was like, just run over that once there so you've done it before the final.
And just to explain to people who aren't into athletics, the steeplechase is a middle distance race, effectively, which are hard enough anyway on the body. All middle distance runners would say so. But they randomly throw in basically like a fence. A water feature. Just a little water jump right in the middle of it to completely mess up your body.
So you've got the hurdles. I think you've five hurdles. And one of the hurdles, and these hurdles don't move if you hit them. So if you hit it, you probably bruise or hurt, like people really damage themselves. And then the water jump is just a massive pit of water after one of the hurdles. So the best thing to do, if you're not incredibly gifted at jumping really long distances, is to jump onto it and then over the water. And I think it's a race that they reserve for people who like hills, like to run on hills or cross country. It's usually cross country runners. And it's the main attraction of the race is the water jump, because people gather at it just to see you fall, which is the main.
So you were saying you hadn't been... Were you even aware of the steeplechase in any great way before your coach?
No, I thought it was something horses did. And then I didn't have much access to hurdles or this kind of thing. So I went out training in the fields, and there were hay bales, which I would jump over as practice, which they're kind of as tall as me. So you just have to put a leg on one side, propel yourself over. And I mean, the dog didn't join me.
The dog wouldn't have fancied that part of it. Yeah, that's incredible trend. It obviously stood you in good stead, though.
I think I was probably jumping like two hurdles high.
You may have won despite the training rather than because of the training.
Yeah. So there was the under 19 and the under 21, and one was 3K and one was 15. The under 19 one, I think we ran with the boys, so I just didn't want any boys to beat me. And then I think there was some other girl in that race. And then in the under 20, that was longer, so I just wanted to survive, because it's really tough on like your core, and you feel like cement about halfway through the steeplechase. It's really hard to keep stopping, and I mean, you're not supposed to keep stopping and starting, but if you're not very good at hurdling and you're doing this big massive leap every time, you are. But the under 19 one was the 1500, and they put the distance up afterwards, so I actually set the record in both those just because it was never run before. I think they actually thought girls couldn't run it safely. And it stands for 18 years because they've never run 1500.
Ah, come on.
I actually don't care.
It'll stand forever.
I mean, it's
an unbreakable record.
To guess, but I do not care about that particular detail. It is a national record and it's never going to be broken.
I know you're playing it down a huge amount here, but that had to have been a big moment for you.
Yeah, and I think actually that might have been the race, the 1500 one, that got me the scholarship, because he did always insist that I was a steeplechaser when I went over there, despite having only ever run the thing two times before. And every season I would be put in the steeplechase, despite never showing any particular any strong ability at it. Yeah.
That's the athletics taken care of. I'm just going through my final calculations here. And I couldn't help but notice in your poem, Sunday Prayers, that you mention Gert Numera. Did you by any chance share a classroom with any of the famous Canning hurlers, Portumna and Galway's finest? Because there is a scatter of them, but like maybe you're too young to have shared a classroom. I mean, I'm just assembling points here any way that I can.
Joe Canning was in my class.
Ah, yeah. The best of the lot.
And
no offence, Ali.
I think he shares my mother's birthday, or is the day before my mother's birthday, which is a good. So I know his birthday.
Yeah.
Joe Canning is Murph's all time. Let's be honest about it, Murph.
I mean,
sporting favourites.
Joe would be uncomfortably close to my favourite people in the world, regardless of sport. So this is a pretty big deal. You were in on the ground floor with Joe Canning.
Four. I started school at four, so, and he was a year older, but I was in his class up until third class because I stayed back. But we went through our communion and there's pictures in our family album of Joe Canning making his first communion. If I had known, I'd have brought you in one.
Oh, no, that's incredible.
All-Ireland final and Evan Boland Award in the same classroom in Gort Numera. That's pretty good.
There you go.
We also had the world champion in Irish dancing in that school, Stephanie Power. So there's something in the water in Gort Numera.
Incredible.
This is ridiculous.
It's all boredom. It's just fields for miles.
Per capita, this might be the most successful school classroom in history. True.
You've built up a strong case to challenge the 90 points amassed by President Higgins last week. Are you ready to try
90?
To
what
do, take
what
down the president?
Did he do?
Look, he's the president, Alvy.
We were in his literal office in the Aura. So I'm not going to say I wasn't a little intimidated.
It's time for you to take him down. Murph, could you please rank this sporting life of Alvy Carrer?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. Could have been somebody.
Well, Alvy, the time has come. For many of our guests, this is the moment they dread when I sharpen my pencil, uncap my red marker, and begin my important vital work. I must now assess your sporting abilities, pick a sports person that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then, having considered your all-time sporting highlight, give you points out of 100 to see if you will be crowned our greatest non-sportsperson of 2025. For an athlete with your sort of talent, however, this is a moment to cherish, to look forward to embrace, in fact. You are a national champion and a long-standing national record holder, a record that apparently will never be broken. And like Rocky Balboa in that Philadelphia meat locker, you were willing to use whatever nature provided to get to the very top, hurdling actual real-life hay bales in preparation for your steeplechase triumph. This is all mightily impressive, if a little unorthodox. Your refusal to give up, your tendency to laugh in the face of exhaustion, reminds me more of none other than Noel Mannion, Ballinasloe's finest, who looked like he was about to have a heart attack after running in a try from his own half for Ireland against Wales in 1989.
Scored the try, though.
You've got that same grit about you. And continuing the East Galway theme, there's this whole Joe Canning angle. You were there on the ground floor of the greatest career in Irish sport. But you weren't happy to stand in Joe's shadow, not for one minute. Instead, forging your own path in the cutthroat world of American collegiate athletics. Further marks are added for surviving being hit by a car mid-race in the TIP cross-country championships. But there will be deductions for not committing to the yee-haw at the start of races at that Louisiana University. It's been a gorgeous hour spent talking to you, Alvy. We really appreciate your honesty, your candor, and your genuinely impressive sporting pedigree. Yeah. It all adds up to 87 points. Not good enough to overtake the president, but good enough for a very strong-looking second place in this year's table. Alvy Carraher, this has been your sporting life.
That's right up there.
Oh, high all 80s time.
Is right up there all time. Abby looks kind of annoyed, I'm not going to be honest. We have established the competitive instincts here.
I mean,
are you okay with the second place?
I feel like it's an A minus.
Can do better.
87 would have won like a large majority
of our series up to now, yeah.
So if it wasn't for the president.
Exactly. You know? Alvy, it's been brilliant. Listen, thank you so much. A round of applause, please, for Alvy Carrer. Thank you.
There's nothing in the press. There's nothing on the telly. I feel a bit sick because there's nothing in my belly. Letter to the letterbox, posters on the pole. The country being ran by greedy beach rolls. One for sorrow, two for joy. It's the shit. I'm the fly.
The Juice, the latest from former contestants Charles and Andrew Hendy, both brutal a sport, if I remember correctly. But
really bad.
Very much doing the business with the rest of the crew in the Merry Wallopers. Alvy Carrer, very much not brutal at sports, 87 points. If a national title doesn't beat President Michael D. Higgins this year, I don't think anything else is going to.
Yeah. Basically, I think what we've learned here, Owen, is that you have to have a more impressive office than Orson Uthron for you to have any chance of taking out President Michael D.
It's a big ask, you'd have to say. Thanks again to Alvy for coming in and speaking so well and so openly with us over the last hour or so. If you've been affected by anything we've spoken about on today's show, you can go to rte.ie/helplines for a list of support services. If you'd like to hear a little more Second Captains before next Saturday, get on to secondcaptains.com for daily shows during the week, or listen wherever you normally get your podcasts. You can also listen to the Second Captains produced international podcast series Steak Knife. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is series producer for Second Captains. Thanks as always to Johnny Lanagan in RTE. Thanks as always to you, Ciarán.
Right back at you, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next Saturday. Take care.